This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Siviso. It's our Health and Living segment and we are discussing the role of surgery in treating cancers today. Dr. Haridharan S. Damodaram, Consultant General and Hepatobiliary Surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Center in the studio with me. Surgery is a very well-known form of treatment for cancers, especially to remove tumours. We all are quite aware of that. Now, as cancer treatments improve and become less invasive, the question becomes, is surgery still necessary? So Dr. Hari is in the studio with us to help us understand that. If you have a question for him, give us a call. The number is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hari. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Who is a hepatobiliary surgeon? Could you explain to us what that is? I mean, general surgeon, we all know. But what is this?
Hepatobiliary refers to the field of the liver, the bile ducts, the pancreas, the gallbladder. Surgery in general is an old field. And with advancements in treatments and new treatments coming up, the field is slowly subdividing itself because more time is needed to achieve expertise in each field. So hepatobiliary surgery is a subsection of general surgery.
Surgery, okay. So it's a subspecialization then.
Yes, correct.
So we're discussing surgical oncology. How does it differ from other subspecialties in cancer, really?
Surgical oncology is not really a subspecialty as such. It's like a subsection of surgery in general. In some countries, some amount of qualifications are necessary to call yourself a surgical oncologist. But in Malaysia, the vast majority of surgeons are trained in high-volume general hospitals, and all of them will have experience in treating patients with cancer. And surgical oncology is actually the application of surgery in patients who have cancer.
As simple as that.
Simply, yes.
Okay. And, you know, how does it differ from when you carry out surgery on a tumour as opposed to just removing someone's appendix, for an example?
So, treating patients with cancer requires a knowledge of the pathology and how the disease affects a person and is slightly different. As in most fields of medicine, there are rules. And if these rules are followed, we will be able to get a decent outcome. And there are some rules to this. So, for example, when you remove an appendix, you have to remove the appendix, and you can do this in many ways. But if you remove a tumor of the appendix, then you have to be careful regarding the blood supply and the possible flow of cancer cells. And you may have to remove with what we call a margin or a rim of tissue which is not involved by cancer cells. So this is in one specific way, one difference between removing an appendix and removing a cancer of the appendix.
So does every general surgeon then remove tumours?
Yes, I think they do. It is a part and parcel of general surgical training. And I think most general surgeons, or in fact all general surgeons, would probably have some element of cancer surgery involved.
Okay, so I'm assuming that you remove cancers or tumours in the liver area, the pancreas area and all of that?
Yes, correct.
And what has that experience been, removing these tumours?
So tumours of the liver and the pancreas, there are many different kinds of cancer, there are many different kinds of tumours. Now, with tumours of the liver, they are very different from tumours of the pancreas, for example, pathologically. They are different types of cancer cells. And the rules that apply in treating patients who have liver cancer and treating patients with pancreatic cancer are very different. So, for example, in liver cancer, we often have to deal with two problems. One is the cancer itself, and another is the disease of the liver itself. And the liver is an organ that you need and you only have one of. So a simple removal of the liver is not possible. So we need to really consider those aspects of this when we treat patients who have a liver tumor. So sometimes we may be able to remove just the tumor. Sometimes we may have to remove the liver, but you may require another liver or transplantation.
Mm-hmm. And but the liver does regenerate to a certain extent.
If you remove part of a normal liver, the liver has the capacity to regenerate. And the number of liver cells that you will have after, sometimes as quickly as 2 weeks after the operation, may be the same as you had before. Mm-hmm. But it all really depends on the quality of the liver as well.
Okay. So let's talk about the role of surgery in cancer care. I mean, how would you describe it? When does it come into play in the whole process of diagnosing and treating cancer?
Well, surgeons actually have been sort of leading treatment in cancer historically. And the reason for this is the vast majority of cancers usually present themselves with a tumor. Now,
go ahead.
These solid tumors sometimes are the reason for the symptoms that you may have. So historically, it was often common that if you did develop cancer, you first would meet a surgeon because your symptoms arise from a growth. And it made sense to remove the growth. So over the last 10 years or so, maybe 10, 20, 30 years, treatments have developed, other than surgery, that can affect one's outcome when treating cancer. So in this case, surgeons have had to become part of a team. And we find that when we treat patients along with other members of this team and other specialties, we get better outcomes.
So it begins from a biopsy stage, for an example?
Yeah, so when a tumor is encountered, there are many things that need to be done or considered before considering treatment. One of them is first to determine the kind of nature of the growth that we encounter. Now, biopsies essentially mean removing a little bit of the tumor and subjecting that to an examination under a microscope. And this is the gold standard of the diagnosis. Now, whether or not a biopsy is necessary prior to treatment of the cancer depends on how sure we are of what we're dealing with before treatment. And it may also depend on how dangerous obtaining that biopsy might be. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that we consider before doing a biopsy. And all surgeons would also understand that there is a risk, albeit a small risk, of spreading the cancer during a biopsy. So these are the things that we consider before doing a biopsy. But yes, surgeons are sometimes involved in the diagnosis of cancer by the need for a biopsy.
But then again, you don't make this decision on your own, as you said. It's always in consultation with a multidisciplinary team.
Yeah. So sometimes, these days especially, if you have a tumor deep inside, biopsies, there are various ways of obtaining a biopsy. Sometimes you may be able to use a radiologist and guide needles using scans and get into the tumor and be able to take a piece of tissue. Sometimes you may use an endoscope in order to get deeper into a particular, say, a lumen or in the colon in order to get a biopsy. So there are ways, and it is important to understand that because there are ways, there are options. And a crucial aspect of treating patients with cancer is explaining these options to them. And it's a challenge, really, to explain it in a way that does not frighten.
Absolutely. I mean, the very fact that you said that, you know, by doing a biopsy, you could actually get the tumor spreading is quite an alarmist something to think about. Because can't do a biopsy, what do you do then? How do you determine whether it's cancer or not?
So every step in the treatment of a patient with cancer requires a certain kind of conversation. Now, the situation is such these days that it's almost become imperative that doctors describe to you all the worst things that could happen. Simply because I think it is the patient's right.
Yes, it is.
To know this, right. So there's this famous story about that lawyers sometimes tell us about. A patient who had a painful eye that was blind had an operation to remove that eye because it was bothering him, it was painful. And after the operation, he developed a very, very rare complication, one in a million, where he lost the sight of his good eye.
Mm-hmm.
And when this was considered in a court of law, because the patient was obviously upset, he felt that if he had known earlier
the risk
that there was even a 1 in 1 billion chance that he might lose the left eye, he would not have subjected himself to that. So these kind of conversations, unfortunately, are very necessary in this time and age. But they have to be put forward to the patient in a way that the patient will be able to understand and may be able to make a rational decision. There are risks in everything that we do. But at the end of the day, sometimes we take those risks in order to achieve the good outcomes.
I mean, you've dealt with many Malaysian patients, I'm sure.
I only treat Malaysians.
How do you explain these things to them? What have been some of your challenges? Cultural barriers? What is it?
I think the biggest barrier is always fear. It's understandable.
Yep.
I don't think it would be easy to convince me to go through an operation. It is simply because at the end of the day, there are so many things that we need to worry about. And
there's more that you know than we know.
Yeah, the more that you know,
the worse it is.
Yes, it's true. So at the end of the day, Malaysians have some characteristics that I think may not be so obvious overseas. For example, Malaysians will have a family. Now, the decision to do an operation is a decision regarding a health decision of any kind may, for most Malaysians, depend on the consensus of a family. So for us, sometimes it is important to make sure that we manage to explain the aspects of these treatments to all the family members who are available and to give them adequate time to decide on these procedures and make these important decisions. One thing that is important to understand is with cancer, very rarely is a decision required immediately. It is probably a good idea to talk it over so that there is a consensus in the family and of all the people who you think should be involved in that decision making.
Okay, that's interesting. No rush.
Very important. And get everybody on your side.
Okay, all right. On your side, exactly, right? Patient always comes first, don't you think?
Yes, I think that is a very important point. But it is not, the patient comes first, but it is not as straightforward as that. It's not that the patient is always right sometimes. And it's actually the responsibility of a doctor to walk the patient through a decision. And sometimes it is a bit of a difficult situation because sometimes it appears like as if you want a patient to do something that the patient may not want to do.
Yeah.
So it is really imperative that the doctor puts the information across and allows the patient to make the decision and the time to do so.
We're discussing the role of surgery in treating cancers. If you have a question for Dr. Hari. He's in the studio with us. He is a consultant general and a hepatobiliary surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Center. If you have a question for us, the number to call 0377332900. You can WhatsApp 0187898899 or just tweet us at BFM Radio. When we come back, we will discuss the success rate of surgery in cancer and whether or not surgery is actually needed when you have a tumor, or can we do without surgery? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, Dr. Haridharan S. Damodaram, he's a consultant general and hepatobiliary surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Center. We are discussing the role of surgery in treating cancers. If you have a question for us, call us the number 0377332900, WhatsApp 0187898899, or just tweet us at BFM Radio. We've gone through interesting issues like, you know, having that discussion with a patient as to, you know, what the surgery is all about, some of your challenges dealing with patients and Malaysians. As you said, fear, I think, is central to, you know, everybody's challenge really when facing with something like cancer. And also what's interesting is you've said the different types of cancer cells that affect the different organs and how that needs to be taken into consideration when you actually do surgery. You know, there are some myths and misconceptions about surgery, Dr. Hari. Some of them you mentioned just now, surgery or biopsy causes cancer to spread. Now, do you think that's a myth or a misconception, or is that really true?
Oh, it is true, but it is extremely rare. So, at the end of the day, I think most surgeons who deal with problems like these on a day-to-day basis, in the course of our careers, we would have seen maybe one or two of these cases. It is unfortunate because if as we all know, if cancer is localized, is in one place, if we remove it, we get a cure in most of the cases. But if we allow a cell to fall into a different part of the human body and give it time to grow, then the chances are we may have lost the ability to cure this tumor, because it spreads from a different location. This kind of seeding of tumors from a biopsy is extremely rare, but it needs to be taken into consideration when a surgery is performed or a biopsy is performed. In many cases, sometimes a preoperative biopsy may not be necessary. In many cases, not in all cases. So, especially if supposing you have a growth that is obviously causing you some discomfort. So sometimes in the course, sometimes if you have, say, come in with an abdominal pain that is very severe, the treatment done is surgery and we remove the tumor and we don't really know what we're dealing with or exactly what we're dealing with at that time. Experience tells us what it most likely is. But in those cases, you don't really require a preoperative biopsy. Sometimes when we do take a preoperative biopsy, it's like, for example, if there is a lump in the breast, if we do a preoperative biopsy, we are careful to include the needle tract or the passage that the needle has taken in order to take the biopsy in future resections of that tumor. This helps us to deal with possible seeding at that time. So these are some of the issues that we keep in mind when we treat with patients with malignancy.
Okay, so that's a biopsy stage. But in terms of surgery itself, you have open surgery, you have minimally invasive surgeries. Has that, you know, is there a particular formula? I mean, I'm sure most of us would want to opt for minimally invasive surgery because, you know, the downtime is quicker, that kind of thing. But what do you take into consideration when deciding between the two?
So, like I mentioned several times before, treating cancer, when offering treatments to a patient with cancer, we offer these treatments because we have established a possible outcome. We know what to expect, but in order to achieve that outcome, we have to follow the rules of the engagement. We have to make sure that things are done according to these rules in order to get the outcome. So if we perform an operation to remove a growth, if we follow the rules, we remove the growth, we remove the parts of that possible sites of spread of that growth, and we establish the spread of this disease with the operation, then we would have achieved the best possible possibility of getting the good outcome that we want. But choosing a different kind of surgery, sometimes the kind of operation that you choose depends on your ability to get that kind of an outcome in the end. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, a minimally invasive procedure can be chosen, and we have seen that it works in these scenarios. In some cases, no, and may still be considered experimental. So if we are going to perform an experimental procedure on the patient, then the patient needs to know that and needs to be aware that, yes, this procedure may cause you less pain, but maybe we are not so sure exactly how it's going to pan out over the next few years. Mm-hmm. So these kind of conversations are necessary, and a surgeon offering these procedures will consider these things when they decide to offer procedures to the patient.
That's a lot of talking.
Sorry. Yeah.
It's a lot of conversations, and you know, we need to ask the right questions as well, isn't it?
I think these kind of conversations are very important, because we don't want patients to undergo treatment with the wrong expectations. They need to be aware. It's not always, oh, this is what I want, so can you do this for me? Mm-hmm. The doctor needs to be able to use his expertise and his experience to guide the patient in that decision.
Managing expectations, always crucial.
It's important for the patient to get the outcomes that they expect. Yes.
We have Muhammad on the line. Muhammad, you have a question.
Hello. Hi. I have a question. This is regarding a very close family member of mine.
Okay.
Who apparently have been diagnosed with cancer in the appendix, which is quite rare. And what happened is that the cancer has actually blown. So the appendix actually blown out. And he did an operation to remove the appendix with the doctor not knowing that it is a cancer. So subsequent to that, he went through the series of chemotherapy and targeted therapy using some drugs by the name of Elocitin, Zeloda, and also for 8 rounds already. And in between, the doctor did quite a number of tests. These are CEA tests as well as PET scan. After the 4th chemotherapy, a PET scan was conducted and found that the findings were actually is quite pretty good. None of the cancer cells are actually still can be detected. So basically, it's gone.
Okay.
But subsequent to the 4th chemotherapy, the CEA reading is going up from 4 to 5, and now the latest one is 8. And queries made to the doctor in charge that response that we got is that there could potentially be a new growth happening in the body, which will require another round of PET scan. My question to the doctor is, number one, is it possible for a series of chemotherapy, if the patient go through a series of chemotherapy, can there be instances where the cancer actually continue to grow elsewhere? And second question is, after each chemotherapy, what can be expected? I mean, the subsequent treatment after that prolonged chemotherapy. And thirdly, if found that the cancer has actually spread, what are the alternative options apart from chemotherapy that can be done? Because the condition of the appendix is that it burst. Therefore, the mucus of the cancer cells actually has spread over to the peritoneum layer of the stomach and everything.
Okay.
I think if you can have some guide on that.
You have got to be a doctor, Muhammad.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Not really. I'm an accountant.
Okay. Well, you know quite a bit. We have a producer position if you're interested.
Right. Okay. It's a learning curve for me, really.
Okay. Thank you for that call.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thank All right.
you.
Bye. Go ahead, Dr. Harry. I mean, there are quite a few questions here. Possible for series of chemo for the cancer to continue to grow elsewhere? Is there a possibility?
Well, Inche Mohammed, I mean, at the end of the day, just going through the history, the presentation of the cancer, unfortunately, is one which makes the prognosis or the outlook not so good, because spreading of cancer cells within the peritoneal cavity, this is the space in which the bowel and the appendix lie in. Spreading of cancer into the peritoneal space gives this cancer cells an opportunity to be beyond where the cancer initially was.
Mm-hmm. In a confined area.
So it is very unlikely that the operation to remove the appendix will be curative. So I guess that is the reason why you may have been subjected, or that your was it your friend or relative who was subjected to
yes.
chemotherapy? And unfortunately, it's difficult for me to comment on the various possibilities, because there are so many possibilities in terms of the type of cancer. And cancer of the appendix with chemotherapy is rare. It is not common that we find this cancer. For that reason, long-term robust evidence as to how well which chemotherapy regime will work is not available. Having said that, yes, some chemotherapy targeted towards the colon and the appendix may be helpful. And the follow-up indicates that there is no spread or recurrence of the disease. However, the recent increase in the CEA merely puts across the possibility. If I understand right, the CEA levels are still below 20.
And, I think it's at 5.
5, 8, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. These levels are very low. So they are tumor markers themselves are not very specific for a particular kind of cancer. It does not mean that because you have a slightly higher than normal level in your tumor markers that you definitely have a cancer. If there is an increase in tumor markers, some amount of investigation and a search for possible sites of cancer is probably prudent, but it is by no means is it diagnostic that the tumor has recurred. With respect to what could you do if...
Other than chemo.
Other than chemotherapy, I'm not very sure. Because at this point, we are dealing with, if the cancer recurs, a lot depends on where this cancer is, what type of cancer cells are we dealing with. Is it the same cancer that has recurred in a new location? Or is it a new cancer? So there are some questions that need to be answered. And I think you sound like, your friend sounds like he's in some capable hands. So perhaps a discussion with the doctors treating him is probably the best way to go.
You spoke about tumor markers. Tumor markers, as you said, is not the best measure of...
Tumor markers are like the bane...
I know. Tons of false positives and false negatives.
So every year I get at least half a dozen patients who come in with raised tumor markers who don't have cancer. But the discussion with them is quite troubling, because I have to convince them that these tumor markers may not necessarily be diagnostic. But they have come to me with the idea that
they
already have cancer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, in many cases, we find ourselves doing tests and further tests to prove a negative. That means that this is not cancer. And there are times that sometimes we are simply stumped. The tumor marker levels are high, but we can't find the cancer. And there have been occasions where I've had to leave the patients at that. Tell them, listen, you come back every few months, we check again and see. But I don't know when to stop. Because, yes, your tumor marker is slightly high, we can't find the cancer. These days, with PET scans, it becomes a little bit easier because we do the PET scan, and then if it is negative, everybody is very happy. Although we must understand that PET scans, while they have the reputation of being a scan that tells you exactly where cancers are in your body, they are not always foolproof. They have they are false positives. More importantly, they are false negatives. So, with tumor markers, it is very important for us to understand what they are and to understand what a positive result or a negative result implies. The majority of tumor markers are not specific and are not sensitive. So when you do a blood test that has a tumor marker that is slightly high, it doesn't mean that you have the cancer. And if your tumor marker level is normal, it does not mean that you don't have the cancer.
So what other option does Muhammad's friend actually have to measure whether the cancer is there or not, besides the tumor marker test?
So one important measure is clinical examination and symptoms. If he is asymptomatic and there are no signs that cancer has returned, that is a good sign by itself. And patients who have undergone chemotherapy for malignancy or tumors in the peritoneum, the best we really do is routine scans. Tumor markers are useful, but doctors need to interpret tumor markers according to the context. So if tumor markers are going through the roof, say you've got a CEA of, say, 80 going on to 100, then you're concerned. If it is a little bit lower, if it is at the level below 10, it's difficult to say for sure exactly what this is.
Okay. Yeah. So look out for the ones going through the roof then.
That would be, okay. Yeah.
Something to think about there. Okay, we are discussing the role of surgery in treating cancers with Dr. Haridharan Damodaram. He's a consultant general and hepatobiliary surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Center. If you have a question for him, call us. The number is 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp us on 018-789-8899. Or you can just tweet us at BFM Radio when we come back. I want to know whether or not or how you manage this conversation about traditional complementary medicine when it's brought up with you in your clinic. How do you manage this conversation? We'll come back and find out more after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi, and in the studio with me, Dr. Haridharan S. Damodaram. He's a consultant general and hepatobiliary surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Center. We are discussing the role of surgery in treating cancers. Very interesting. Just to follow up on the discussion on tumor markers just now, we have somebody on WhatsApp who's asking, if tumor markers are not conclusive, why even use them? Is it a waste of money?
Tumor markers are used generally to monitor progress. They give us some information about where the tumor is, whether it is responding to treatments that are given. It really should not be used for screening. So we use tumor markers for that reason. So let's say you have started chemotherapy and you want to see how well your tumors are responding. Let's say you've had a tumor marker that started at, say, arbitrarily 100 units. If you've given your treatment and you have found that it has come down to, say, below the normal value, say, at 4 or 5, then you're a little happy. And then when you see it creeping up, you might think maybe tumor is recurring. This gives you an idea that there may be something that needs to be looked into, and this will lead to more investigations which are a bit more sensitive and a bit more specific, like scans, for example, or scope. And treatment decisions will be based on that. So the tumor markers, like most blood test results, they are not going to give you all the information, but when you put all the information together, all these pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, you get an idea of what to do next.
I suppose the bane you were talking about is the general screening
exactly
process,
yeah, correct,
where
correct.
We all do blood tests, you know,
and it's in almost every panel, isn't
yes.
it? So yeah, sometimes we don't really know what to do about it. I think people look for reasons or look for tests or look for ways to find out if they have cancer. It is something on the back of their mind. However, when they go for a medical checkup, they find out actually that proper screening of cancer is a bit more tedious than just a blood test. So, say for example, if you have a worry that you have breast cancer, depending on your age, you might need an ultrasound or a mammogram, and that is a little bit more tedious than having a blood test. So, it is easy to sell blood tests to someone who wants to know whether they have cancer, but it is important to let that person know beforehand what a positive or negative result means, so that they understand, and then they can decide whether they really want to do that test or not.
Okay. I asked you earlier that when we come back, we'll discuss how you have this conversation about traditional complementary medicine with your patients. Now they come to you, you say surgery is actually required. As you said, as a surgeon, there's a lot of conversations that involve the patient, the family, and yourself, you explaining what the risks are and all of that. And sometimes that can be a put off. I might decide that I don't want to do this surgery and seek alternative or complementary treatment. Now I broach this topic with you. How will you manage this conversation?
So this is another aspect of the conversation that is very Malaysian, I think. I don't know, actually, to be honest with you, it sounds like as if it's becoming more and more international. But for Malaysian patients, they don't usually come right out and say, listen, I'd rather do traditional medicines. They will be doing the traditional medicines quietly, maybe without even letting you know. And in some ways, that is more dangerous than actually having that conversation with the doctor. So the first important point I would like to make on alternatives and traditional medicine is, I think it is vital that you inform the doctors that you have considered and or you are taking traditional medicines. The other thing to understand is traditional medicines and alternative medicines probably include everything that you have been taking. So a lot of patients, when I ask them, are you taking any herbs? Are you taking any traditional medicines? They will say no. That's the first thing that they will say. And then 10 seconds later, it will be like, oh, actually, I'm taking this supplement. And then they mention some medications that they are taking, which are obviously not mainstream medicine. And sometimes they convince themselves that it is not mainstream medicine. But it is important to let the doctors know who are treating you if you are taking traditional medicines. Now, if you are somebody who feels that mainstream medicine is not for you, and that having had a discussion with a doctor, you have opted to not take the expected course of treatment. For a doctor, at the end of the day, the important thing is to let you know what are the options available to you. A doctor, I suppose, in mainstream allopathic medicine cannot suggest traditional and alternative medicines that he has no knowledge of. So he may not be able to refer you to alternative medicines, even though that may be what you want. But if you have decided to do that, I can only hope that you have had adequate information about the pros and cons of these medications that you have decided not to take, or the medications that now you intend to take. So for allopathic doctors, traditional medicine remains a gray area. We are not well versed with what is available in alternative and traditional medicines. And sometimes we are not sure exactly what these medications can do. And that being so, we are unable to give you much advice regarding this. The only thing is, if you tell us what medications that you are on, we will be able to tell you whether or not it is safe to combine these treatments. I don't know if that answers your question, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, the truth of the matter is nobody really knows too much about the alternatives and traditional medicines, except for those who profess it. So sometimes we have to leave them to their decisions. A patient has decided, we cannot force any decisions on them, but they must make this decision with all the necessary information.
An informed decision.
Yeah.
Okay. Just coming back to surgical oncology, have there been any advancements that would improve treatment and care for patients when it comes to surgery?
Well, advancements, improvements in surgery, they are occurring fairly frequently. At the end of the day, how we treat patients with cancer 20 years ago is very different from how we treat patients with cancer today. It is important for a person who has been diagnosed to not be fearful of treatment and to have honest discussions with the doctors that you have regarding all the various treatment options. Some treatment options are available close to you. Some treatment options you may have to move or you may have to go some distance to obtain. In many fields, it's a very general topic, surgical oncology. So in many fields, advancements have occurred. You mentioned, for example, laparoscopic surgery, robotic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Surgeries that may not be associated with so much discomfort and may be more acceptable to you. So depending on the kind of condition that you have, there are so many more options that you have today compared to many years ago, and outcomes have improved. And the important thing is, I think you should avail yourself of those opportunities.
For those who, you know, surgery is not possible to remove a tumor, how do you then get rid of it?
Surgery is not possible.
Or is surgery always
needed? Actually, at the end of the day, we do deal with patients these days who present with conditions or advanced tumors, which unfortunately make treatment, which have poor treatment outcomes. So if you have a tumor that cannot be removed, there are alternatives, of course. Different types of diseases have different treatment algorithms, and there are options available. Say, for example, in pancreatic cancer, if you have a tumor which has not bothered you in any way, and after a while you realize maybe that something is slowly going wrong, you get tested, you find out that the tumor is a little bit bigger than, you find out that you have a tumor. Now, what constitutes a resectable or removable tumor has changed over the last, say, 15 years, because we do find that there are maneuvers that we can do using a combination of chemotherapy followed by surgery, which allow us to get maybe slightly better outcomes with surgery. So these kind of advancements have occurred, and it is important for patients to have discussions with their doctors. Sometimes, unfortunately, with cancer, we may reach a point where we need to have a really frank conversation about outcomes, and it may not be possible to treat a patient or to cure a patient with an advanced tumor. These kind of scenarios may require the aim of treatment to shift from the removal or the eradication of cancer to the treatment of the symptoms that bring discomfort.
Okay. And treating the symptoms.
Treating the symptoms may be the most, to be honest with you, irrespective of the stage of the disease, it is what a patient wants. If he has a symptom, he would like it to be treated. We do sometimes confuse treating a symptom with eradication of the disease. Patients sometimes don't understand the difference. In some cases, patients come to us at an early stage where there are no symptoms. And in these situations, sometimes the patient is bewildered because he has been diagnosed with something and he's being told, he's being given bad news, but he knows something needs to be done about it. He's not sure how this is going to make him feel after the treatment is done, because as far as he's concerned, he's well. Again, these are very important conversations that need to be held. With patients who come with advanced disease, the concept of palliative care needs to be approached, and that needs to be done with some tact, I suppose. There is a difference between giving up on a patient and improving the quality of life of a patient. Surgery does have some role in palliative care. And again, it comes down to discussions that you have with your doctors. And the important thing is not to be afraid of treatment and to avail yourself with what is available.
Thank you very much for joining us today. That was Dr. Haridharan S. Damodaram, Consultant General and Hepatobiliary Surgeon from Subangjaya Medical Centre, speaking to us about the role of surgery in treating cancers on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.